how often are you focused on catching a big fish, a trophy fish? And would you like to find out where in the world you have a legitimate shot at a trophy muskie? And how much would you spend on gear and tackle and everything you need to get in a place to have a chance at catching a world record fish? One of the biggest names in the history of muskie is on the show today, and he's got some crazy stories that are going to shed some insight on the muskie and share some tips and tricks as we go along the way. This is the Wet Fly Swing Podcast, where I show you the best places to travel to for fly fishing, how to find the best resources and tools to prepare for that big trip, and what you can do to support the fish species we love. Hey, I'm Dave, host of the Wet Fly Swing Podcast. I've been fly fishing since I was a little kid. I grew up around a little fly shop and have created one of the largest fly fishing podcasts in this country. I've also interviewed more of the greatest anglers than just about anyone in the world. With over 60 years of fishing muskie and working in conservation, Larry Ramsell has seen just about everything. From trying to remove bogus IFGA records due to guys putting bolts and sand into muskie to increase the weight, to population collapses around the area from killing too many fish, it's been Larry's mission to set the record straight and preserve muskie for all of us for the long term. In this episode, you're going to find out which tools you need for proper landing a fish. You're going to find out which three big issues you need to address to protect these muskie. And we're going to find out why the follow has impacted so many muskie fishermen over the years. Plus, you're going to hear about why people are spending $900 for a lure and Larry's take on the current status of muskie. We touch on it all going way back and bringing it to present day. Another epic old school angler who paved the way for all of us. Here he is, Larry Ramsell from LarryRamsell.com. How you doing, Larry?
Doing just great.
Hey, I appreciate you for taking the time to come on here to talk about a very popular species fish, you know, muskie. I think no matter where you are in the world, I think people, it's on their bucket list. They want to maybe have a day chasing muskie. But I want to talk about the muskie itself, you know, how it's doing up in Wisconsin and maybe around the region, you know, and maybe talk about some of the big, you know, you've written a number of books and maybe some tips that can help people understand muskie a little better. But maybe before we get there, take us back into fishing. What's your first memory of fishing and when did you get started?
Well, I got started when I was about knee high to a grasshopper. My dad got hooked with muskie fishing from our neighbor, and he went up to northern Wisconsin and they caught a pretty nice fish, and that infected him, I guess, pretty seriously, because after that it was 2 weeks in June on vacation, and then 4th of July and Memorial Day, and usually a September trip after that.
Wow.
Been doing it for 68 years.
There you go, 68 years. So that takes us back. And if you go back to when, I mean, when did you start getting really heavily into muskie, where you felt like you were becoming, you know, this was your thing, it was all consuming?
Well, I caught my first legal one in 1957, and as soon as I got a car or my buddy's car, we were off and running. I fished all over North America and most of Canada that has muskies. I fished in like 23 states and 2 provinces of Canada.
Yeah. Are muskie, how are they, maybe talk about that just for high level people that don't know. What's their distribution look like? Are they, where are they native and where do we find them?
Well, the native ranges is St. Lawrence River, Georgian Bay, the Ohio River drainage, down into Kentucky. Mm-hmm. There have been muskies at one time as far south as northern Alabama, but I don't think there's anything there anymore. And then the Mississippi River, the Wisconsin Chippewa River, and the Wisconsin River, and eastern Minnesota. That's pretty much the native range, but with stocking and propagation, now they're everywhere.
Yeah, they're everywhere. Okay, all over, pretty much all over the country.
At least in the northern half of the U.S. and Ontario and Quebec.
Yeah, right, up all the way. Where can you find, I mean, where are some of the largest muskie ever caught, like record-wise? Where would you find those?
St. Lawrence River, Georgian Bay. That's even though I'm a Hayward, Wisconsin native, which is, they call themselves the home of world record muskies, I think maybe 1 out of 5 is legitimate. The records of the 30s and the 40s are all bogus.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Various reasons why I think it happened, but It's since been proven not to be as big as claimed. But the true giants, to give you a little bit of science background on it, are a doctoral student that I helped on his thesis field work. He was of the mindset, and his thesis, in his mind, proved that there are two different species of muskies. And the difference being that waters that have always had muskies and northern pike coexisting together produce the biggest fish. Waters where there are no northern pike but just muskies, those fish rarely grow much over 40 pounds. And so what I always tell people in my seminars is that if you're fishing a lake where the lake record is 35 pounds, guess what? You're never going to see a world record class fish there.
Yeah.
And still today, after as much as it's been preached, a lot of people still think everywhere they go that's supposed to got muskies in it, they got a chance at a world record. It's just not going to happen.
No. And what is a world record? What would be a world record right now or a chance at one?
Well, there are three different record organizations. There's the International Game Fish Association, IGFA, in Florida, who got into freshwater record keeping after Field and Stream gave it up in 1979. Then there's the Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame here in Hayward that I built the record program for in the early 70s. And then after all the confusion and chaos went on over muskie records starting around, well, first in 1992, and then again we had a really big battle in 2006. And so I resigned from the Hall of Fame, and I started a new muskie record program called the Modern, the website's modernmuskierecords.org. And our record is 58 pounds of fish caught in Bel Air Lake in Michigan in 2013. IGFA recognizes the Cal Johnson fish from Hayward here, supposedly 67.5 pounds. And the Hall of Fame recognizes Louis Spray's fish, supposedly caught here in 1949, that weighed supposedly 69 pounds, 11 ounces. But, like I say, those last two are been proven to be bogus, and I don't think they get that big.
Oh, so you don't think muskie actually get... What is the largest muskie?
There's always a possibility of a freak.
Yeah.
In fact, I should include New York. They still recognize Art Lawton's supposed 69-pound, 15-ouncer from the St. Lawrence River in 1957. So take your pick. There's four records that you can look at. Lawton caught a lot of big fish, did one weigh 69-15. I wasn't there, so I can't say. Part of me wants to believe it, part of me don't. But, you know, since for the last 20 to 25 years, musky fishing has grown exponentially. Al Lender said it's the only segment of freshwater fishing that's still growing, and it is still today growing. And, of course, they're being stocked everywhere. Minnesota finally figured out how to catch the what's called the Sympatrick strain, the musky pike together, grow big strain, and started stocking them in their lakes. And for about 10 or 12, 15 years, they had the greatest thing going on the planet. And lots of 50-pound-plus fish were caught. Still a few being caught. New Minnesota state record caught 2 years ago. We'd 54, I can't remember the exact number, 56 pounds, 14 ounces, something like that. But anyway, that was Leech Lake or Mississippi River strain stocked in Lake Vermilion, which has always had muskies but never a fishable population, and in Mille Lacs, which hasn't had a viable muskie population since the early 1900s until they started stocking the Leech Lake strain and some Wisconsin strain fish that had potential to grow big over there.
Okay.
But, you know, pretty much need big water and the right genetics to get the world-class fish.
Okay, so big water and the right. And like you said, the muskie and northern pike, those places, that can. Why do you think that is? Why is it that with muskie and northern pike you find the largest?
Well, Bernard LeBeau, the gentleman who became a doctor, his theory was that because the pike spawn earlier than the muskies get the baby gets eaten by the little bit bigger northern pike. And so they evolved over 10,000 years a strategy of spawning in deep water where the pike are not there to bother them. And because they're spawning in deep water, the egg loss is a lot more than it would be if they were spawning in shallow water like pike do. So his opinion was that Mother Nature created or evolved a capacity for that strain to have many, many more eggs, like 4 to 5 times as many eggs as the non-pike muskies that only spawn once, and the big muskies spawn twice. They generate so many eggs that they can't all ripen in the ovaries at the same time, so they have to spawn about 50% of the eggs out, and then a couple of weeks later they come back to the spawning grounds and dump the rest of them.
Wow.
So that's the theory.
So that's it. And then staying on that size track, so what do you think is the largest muskie that's ever been caught out there, or maybe even ever seen?
Well, the biggest one I can verify is 61 pounds and 4 ounces.
Yeah.
And that was caught in Georgian Bay. It's just, you know, that it was supposedly a new Canadian record caught in 88 that weighed 65 pounds. Well, 8 days after it was caught, I was on the scene, and I took the fish out of the freezer, and I reweighed it twice on two different scales, had both of those scales checked by Canadian weights and measures people, and they both were accurate. And when I reweighed it, it weighed 56 pounds. They just don't lose 9 pounds in the freezer. To give you an example how I can prove that is the modern day record, which is my program. 4 months after it was caught, it was shipped to Minnesota to a place to have a replica made of it. So I went there. I was there when they thawed the fish out. I remeasured it. I reweighed it. It hadn't lost any weight. There was a discrepancy of 1 inch in the length measurement, but I think that was due to the fact that whoever measured initially probably used a soft tape and measured up over the curve of the body. The proper measurements on a flat surface, measuring on the flat surface from tip of tail to tip of jaw, and it was 58 inches.
58, yeah, okay.
At a 29-inch girth, it was a monster.
Wow.
And it didn't have anything in it. That's one of the requirements of my program. We have to have somebody there when the fish is opened to verify stomach contents, and this fish had nothing in it but the skeleton of a 13.5-inch smallmouth bass with all of the head and all the meat gone completely, and it had 2 1/3 pounds of eggs in it. That was all. So, you know, that proved that it was a legitimate fish.
Oh, legitimate as opposed to what would be illegitimate? Are people like doing, what would they be doing to it to make it illegitimate?
Well, for instance, the other two record programs, the IJFA and the Hall of Fame, IJFA even recommends releasing a world record if possible. The only thing they don't allow is weighing the fish in the boat, which means you got to get out of the boat and you'd stand on the bottom or on shore and weigh the fish on a scale that has to be certified, and they would accept it. Well, they don't have any way to prove if anything was added to the fish before it was weighed, which is the reason I put that rule in my program, is because so many things in past history have been done to enhance. For instance, Len Hartman supposedly had, him and his wife supposedly had 6 fish over 50, 60 pounds. And I've got a 32-minute video of him confessing that that was not the fact, and that they had added wet sand to the fish, took it to a supermarket, and got somebody walking down the aisle to verify the weight. And it's easy to verify what you see on the scale, but what you don't verify is what's in the fish.
Wow. So he admitted that he stuffed it with sand.
Right. So I suspect that taxidermists have found Coke bottles full of sand and rocks. And, you know, Louis Spray's first record, they were accused of going to his fishing buddy's house and cleaning out his garage for nuts and bolts and stuff like that to enhance the weight, which is probably what happened.
Gosh, this is crazy. So this is like Really interesting to hear. And I mean, you are probably, I mean, I think one of the most, you know, famous names in muskie out there presently, but Louis Spray, who are some other people? Who is, maybe you can describe that. Who is Louis Spray?
Well, Louis Spray was a tavern owner here in Hayward in 1939. In 38, a friend of his had won some money on the Field and Stream contest with a big fish. And so Louis thought he'd get in on that game. And, he came up with, in 38 and 39, a couple of big fish, but the 39 fish was world record caliber, supposedly 59 and a half pounds. And I think what happened, 39, the war's beginning, coming out of the Depression. Tourism is at a low ebb here in the Hayward area. He needed some business for his bar, so what better way to than a big fish?
Oh, wow.
So his fish was beaten twice before 1939 ended. So, lo and behold, if he doesn't come up with another one in 1940.
Right.
Unbeknownst to him, it was beat before it was caught. So he couldn't make that record claim stick, although he tried to the rest of his life. And there are still some historians, quote unquote, here that support all of his fish to the detriment of every other big fish that's ever been caught. In other words, if it wasn't caught in this area, it didn't exist. So anyway, 1940, he did it again. So he got beat again, and things were quiet for a while. He sold his tavern and went to Rice Lake and bought another tavern. And in 1949, Cal Johnson supposedly came up with a new world record out of a local lake here in Hayward. And supposedly weighed 67 and a half pounds and 5 feet long. And they had a big celebration, and he won a new car. While they were having the celebration, Louis sent a telegram, and he said, "Don't award the prize yet. I'll have a bigger one before the season's out," if he didn't. So he came up with his 69-pound, 11-ouncer.
Wow. And what do you think happened with that 69? How did that one get to 69 pounds?
I think they put stuff in it, put water in it or whatever.
Yeah.
We had professional photogrammetry done on his 1940 and his 1949 fish, and they were both proven to be far in excess in the mounted fish than the original fresh fish. And the photogrammetry was done by the top guy in photogrammetry in North America.
Today's episode is sponsored by Togan's Fly Shop, who provides superior quality products at an affordable price. An amazing resource for fly tying materials, tools, and fishing accessories. Since 2005, Togan's has been over-delivering on price, service, and passion. And now you can check out that Togan's buzz for yourself. Right now you can head over to wetflyswing.com/Togan's to get started. That's T-O-G-E-N-S. You support this podcast by clicking through that link to Togan's online. Hey anglers, there's a new story to be told with every cast, and the storyteller, the Yellowstone 2 Fly Rod by Jackson Hole Fly Company. At its core, the Yellowstone 2 boasts a fast-action design constructed from IM-8 graphite. Enhanced with titanium line guards, the rod promises not just distance, but precision, making every cast an extension of your intent. And with resilience against wear and tear, this rod is designed for both the passion of today and the challenges for tomorrow. Featuring a moisture-resistant Portuguese cork grip and a distinctive transparent burled maple reel seat that seamlessly pairs with our Yellowstone Grizzly fly reels, this rod masterfully combines function and finesse. Crafted with love, designed for excellence, the Yellowstone 2 is more than just a fly rod. It's a companion for every adventure, every solo, and every memory on the water. Learn more at JacksonHoleFlyCompany.com. So those have all been pretty much debunked, although you said the IFGA still considered some of those to still the records?
They still got the Johnson fish, and I've had a couple go-arounds with them. The reason they disqualified the Lawton fish in 1992, after Detloff did an amateur analysis of it, and so they didn't disqualify Lawton's record. They set it aside with the claim that they weren't sure that the photograph was depicted to be the record fish was actually that big. So they put set aside status. But then later years, they reversed their claim that world records can only be determined by scale weight. to do with photographs. So if that's the case, Lawton not only had five witnesses to the weighing of his fish after Detloff got it debunked by the Hall of Fame and set aside by IJFA, some of the original witnesses re-affidavited, and a couple of new witnesses came forward that were around at the time that Lawton caught the fish. And so there was a whole new set of affidavits. So there was double affidavits that Lawton's fish weighed what they said it weighed, and yet IGFA wouldn't reinstate it. And I think the reason why is Cal Johnson was a well-known outdoor writer for 50 years, and
they didn't want to stir up stuff,
or they didn't want to disparage him.
Gotcha. Wow. What an interesting history there. So, and when did this all, you might have mentioned it, but when did Muskie really start getting really popular, like in the masses?
I would say, well, Muskie's Inc. was formed in 1966.
Okay.
And after a few years, came up with the idea that, that Muskie's are too valuable to catch only once and kill after it took them 20 years to get big.
Yep.
So it's promoting catch and release really heavily. And it took a few years in some places, but it caught on almost immediately. And as the sport grew in popularity, it's at the point now where a lot of young muskie fishermen wouldn't dream of killing one. If you kill a big fish today, you get crucified on the internet.
Yep.
That's just the way it is. And because more and more big fish were being caught, because more and more fish were being let go and they had a chance to grow, that increased the interest in the sport, and it just went crazy. They started having muskie-specific sports shows, and now there's probably four or five of them every spring, from Canada to New York, Pennsylvania to
everywhere.
Kentucky to Chicago and Minneapolis.
That's so cool. So basically, the conservation efforts of Muskie Inc. and others basically spurred on people to increases in populations, which actually increased the popularity of muskie around the country.
Right, and had the popularity continued to grow and catch and release hadn't taken effect, the fishery would be gone.
It'd be done.
Yeah.
Well, and this is not abnormal for lots of fisheries. You could probably name any fishery in the country, and whether that's Great Lakes, you know, whatever, salmon, steelhead, West Coast. I mean, killing fish, you know, at some point, you know, in certain populations can have a detrimental effect. But I mean, now as it is, you know, these muskies, where do you see it going now? Where we are currently? Maybe talk about the status of where we are with muskie and where you think it's going to be in 20 years.
Well, I think what needs to happen now is, yes, we have, I wouldn't say 100% catch and release, but probably 90-95%, or give or take 3% either way, catch and release. But what we don't have is proper handling.
Mm.
There's so many people new to the game that, A, have never handled a big fish like that. And if they catch it like a 40-pound fish, most of them are scared to death of it.
Yeah.
And so it gets netted, hauled into the boat, it flops around on the floor, and then they take it out of the net and hold it for 15 pictures, and everybody in the boat's got to hold it for a picture, and
right,
the next thing you know, you release the fish and it swims off and dies. So there's estimates as high as 30% mortality from handling, even though the fish is released. So I think that's the next thing that needs worked on. Plus, right now, there's a big flap going on about this forward-facing sonar.
Mm.
The muskies no longer have an opportunity to find a place to hide and get away from anglers. And even though they still catch and release them, I mean, you know, guys are going out and catching 350 inches in a day when they wouldn't catch that many in a month without facing sonar. And even the new Minnesota record, you know, the guy, I give the guys credit, they had to break ice. It was late November and it was night, and, you know, they earned their bones, but they still had the advantage of forward-facing sonar.
Mm.
So in my mind, there should be an asterisk next to that record. But to give you an idea, I'm an old timer. I've been at it since the days of nothing but a pair of oars and no depth finder except a weight on the end of a string and an old electric motors. And I'm 82 years old. I've got a bad shoulder, needs replaced. And you would think somebody like me would love to have a device to where I can sit in the boat and watch the screen all day driving around the lake and maybe make 25 or 30 casts a day instead of casting 1,000 times in a day with my bad shoulder, but I don't want anything to do with it. It just, to me, it's not musky hunting. It's just, you know, it's spotting a fish on TV and throwing a bait to it, and either it bites or it don't.
Right.
It takes the hunt, and it takes the sport, and I believe it takes a little bit of the ethics out of the game.
Yeah. I always love to make the sports analogies, but it kind of sounds like the baseball, the steroids, right? A similar thing where you put steroids into this thing, and then it's really, there's no comparison to past people that hit homers. I mean, this is the same thing with this, the forward-facing sonar.
Right.
I mean, and what do you do about that? I mean, like, this is just a technology. Is that something you think you can...
Well, there are some places trying to decide whether they need to ban it or not, but the problem would be enforcement.
Yeah.
I mean, if the guy's got the equipment, the boat, who's to say whether it's on or not? You know, you can't really ban the equipment from the boat. So I don't know how they're handling it other than to hopefully promote more and better handling if you're catching more and more bigger fish, because those are the breeders. Those are the ones that have, you know, the big ones are the ones that have the good genetics.
Yep.
And those are the ones that need to live. And, you know, if they're getting harassed every day,
man,
they may quit spawning.
Yeah. What is, I want to ask you a couple things. You mentioned musky ink, which I've heard a lot about. Also, you know, we have a movement in fly fishing that's kind of called keep them wet. You know, the idea being is that you just keep the fish in the water and try not to take it out of the water. Is that, maybe talk about your proper fish handling and releasing. What does that look like for somebody?
Well, the biggest thing is to have the proper tools before you ever get in the boat. You got to have a good pair of bolt cutters, like a Nipex that'll cut a 4X treble hook, 7-aught. And, you know, a lot of guys don't even use a net anymore. They just hand them at the side of the boat and don't take them out of the water. And reach down, pop the hooks out. If they want a measurement, they use a floating ruler, put it next to the fish. It's not 100% accurate, but it's close enough. I mean, and as far as photographs, how many pictures do you need of a 38-inch fish when you've caught thousands of them already? You know, and if you've got a really big fish, like a 50-incher for some people, they're first one ever, that's no problem with me having them take a picture of that fish. But then, you know, once you get to the point like I'm at, I mean, we still take a few pictures, but, you know, we do it usually when it's cold weather, and we know the survivability is a lot better. But most of the time, they're quickly released, and we're off casting again.
Gotcha.
But, yeah, the proper tools is a big thing.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the other thing is that they're a dangerous fish to handle if you don't know what you're doing. So you got to learn how to get a hold of them properly so you can cut the hooks or get the hooks popped out with a pair of needle-nose pliers. And then, you know, there's a tool called a hook pick. It's a long 1/8-inch round stainless steel rod that's got an S-curve bend on the end of it that you can reach way down in the mouth of one of these big fish without getting your hand endangered and either hook and pull it out or push the hook backwards to get the barb to pop loose and then lift it right out. My grandson caught a 57-incher with me and it was hooked deep. And so I said, you go through the gill covers while I hold this fish from the back and cut the barbs off the back hook. And I took the hook pick and reached in. The front treble was one of the barbs or one of the hooks was around the gill raker. And I just hooked with my hook pick and backed it up over the gill raker and lifted it out and saved a fish that was probably 25 years old that, you know, still a big spawner and otherwise would have been dead fish.
Wow, 25. Is that about as old as muskie get?
Muskie that size is going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 25 or maybe even older. I mean, they've been aged as much as 29 years by the Cleather method and 33 years by the scale method, which tells me that fish was even older than that, because as the fish gets old, the outer edges of the scales deteriorate, and so it's under aging them from what they really are. And there was one fish that they aged that was 33 years old by scale, so who knows how old that sucker was.
Wow.
And the two strains, just get back to that for one quick second.
Oh, yeah.
And we were talking about the bigger capacity of eggs.
Yeah.
For the bigger strains. the supposed 65-pounder Canadian record, we got the eggs out of that when we were doing the field work, and it had 850,000 eggs in it.
Jeez.
And that's to compensate for the number of eggs that are going to be lost. I mean, wow. You know, probably 1% of them survived. But still, because they're spawning in deep water, they have to lay more eggs. And if you check the literature, all the research prior was done on the smaller strains, species, call them whatever you want. Mm-hmm. And the average of all the research that's been done on those fish is 135,000 to 250,000 eggs. And the eggs are a lot smaller in diameter than the eggs that we handled from this big fish. So there's different lakes have different size eggs, and different waters have, you know, better genetics than others. And it's a crazy game when you get into the genetics. Even the same watershed, like the St. Lawrence River's got several widenings in about 150 miles of musky territory. And every pool on the St. Lawrence River's got slightly different genetics, even though it's all the same river.
Wow. So they're totally keyed into their specific little, not even region, just area of the lake.
Right. And that's all over a long period of time of evolution. And so that's why biologists, where they're stocking now, they're very careful if it's a lake that has some natural reproduction but needs a little help. They want to use eggs from that watershed. And then Canada now, other than restoration, does no stocking whatsoever. Everything up there now is naturally reproducing.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the other places are trying to get to that point too, but Wisconsin's got things mixed up for so much for over 125 years that they're trying to close the barn door after the horse is out.
Right.
But they have good intentions, and eventually, maybe 100 years from now, it'll take effect, but it won't do me any good.
Right, gosh. And you mentioned, you know, before the pike and musky areas, and then there's just the busky areas. What is, you know, the pike is a fish that you hear about that's maybe easier to catch. Why is the musky a smarter fish, or how is it different than a pike?
Well, you know, I've been at it for a long time, and they are definitely different, even though they're first cousins. The pike, and there's two different statuses of pike.
Oh.
Most of the prolific pike waters are smaller pike, and they're shallow water pike. Lakes and rivers that produce really big pike are deeper and colder, and that's the ones that produce the big pike. But they're just, for some reason, they're eating machines, and they get themselves in trouble a lot easier than muskies do. Pike are not known for following a bait. Muskies drive a guy to drink following the bait. Unless you're in a situation that has had very little pressure. For instance, back in the 90s, I started fishing the Ottawa River. And it was about 10 years before I ever saw a follow. But if you fish these northern Wisconsin lakes, you're liable to see 25 or 30 follows before you get a strike.
Wow.
But the follow is what made a lot of musky fishermen. They, you know, say a 45-inch fish follows a guy's surface bait to the boat. He's about to wet his pants. And, you know, they get really excited. Of course, that 45-incher, when they get back to the bar, was 55 or 60 inches. But,
yeah, exactly, or 70.
But that's the way it is with all species, I think.
Yeah, no, it's true. The one that got away, right? The one that you didn't, nobody, the fish story. I mean, that's the
it
funny
was
thing.
As long as an oar.
Exactly.
Know?
I love it because it's a fish. Or what about that fish? Isn't there a fish in Hayward that's mounted that's got some story, the chin whisker or something? Isn't there a...
That's Sprague 6911.
Oh, that's
chin
one.
Whisker, sorry. But the mount was burned up. So the only thing left now are replicas that are horrible.
Oh, so that is his fish.
But what happened was when Louis had his fish in Rice Lake after he left Hayward, he was going to remodel a building and make it his real estate office, and he had his mounts in there, and he went there to do some work one winter day and turned the furnace up, and it was one of the little oil heaters, and he supposedly went to the post office or something, and while he's gone, the furnace blew up and burnt the building down and his mounts along with it.
Jeez.
So that was also a convenient way for nobody to ever take a good close look at the mounts and
right.
see what was done to them to make them bigger than they should have been.
Right. Gosh. Okay. So
but, you know, it makes for great tales.
Yeah, that's it. That's the story. And so it's still a tale. So when
I mean, it's part of the history. You got to love it because it's part of the history.
Yeah.
But, you know, back in the day, records weren't scrutinized anything like they are today. So somebody could make a claim. Back in the 30s, like Lake of the Woods, 29, 30, 31, 32, and even later, a lot of big fish were caught and entered in the field and stream contest, and they weighed on the scale at the camp and probably had never been certified, or if it was, it was probably 20 years ago. And, you know, but field and stream didn't check that stuff, even when it was a world record.
Different time. What is, you know, Muskies Inc., I think you're still on the board there. You've been a big member of that group. Talk about why that was formed and maybe what they're doing. I know they're doing some restoration work. Maybe talk about that a little bit.
Well, what started it was Gilham was he's a great guy, a friend of mine. He's long gone now, too. But he got tired. He lived in St. Paul, Minnesota. He was a contractor. And he used to go to Lake of the Woods to fish muskies. And he got to thinking one time, why is everybody going through Minnesota to fish muskies instead of fishing them in Minnesota? So he decided to do something about it. And he formed a board and December of 66, and Muskies Inc. was born, and it's just, I suppose we got over 50 chapters now, and I was international president in 81, 82, but it's just, you know, with thousands of members, and everything that's generated goes to the fishery. I mean, we buy fish. We can no longer buy fish here in Wisconsin now, so we have to pay to have the fish raised, and we also donate money to the hatchery so they can feed them further into the fall before they stock them so they're a little bit bigger and have a better chance to survive. So it's been quite the deal. And, of course, there are a lot of other muskie clubs as well. There's in Wisconsin, I don't know how many there are, there's an organization called the Muskie Clubs of Wisconsin. And that's the umbrella organization for all the little clubs. And Muskies Inc. too are all of our Wisconsin chapters belong to that organization as well. But just to give you an idea, just our Hayward chapter here in Wisconsin, small chapter, most of our members from somewhere else because they come here to fish. But we have donated over $1 million in the last 20 or 25 years to the fishery, the muskie fishery here. So that's what Muskies Inc. does. We raise lots of money, we raise lots of fish, and help lots of fisheries.
That's really great. And do you guys, and is there some component of like restoration, or what is the restoration that's going on out there? Are there actual habitat type projects, or what does that look like?
Yeah, there's some of that going on, but that's such a hard, expensive, long-term proposition. There's more emphasis on that than anything else on stocking. For instance, in Sawyer County here where I live, we have 54 muskie lakes. But we don't know which one of them were native muskie lakes and which one of them were stocked by fishing clubs back in the 20s when they could get fish from the hatchery. They had a fish train to make a run across the state, and all you had to do was let them know you needed some fish and be at the whistle stop when they got there. And yeah. They'd offload milk cans full of baby muskies. They'd load them in a wagon and take them, and nobody ever knew where they went.
Right.
So that's why we don't know which lakes. The only ones we can prove are native lakes that are hooked to the river systems. Because that's where the native muskies came from. They came. Oh. They refuged in the Mississippi River below the glaciers. The last glacier was about 10 to 12,000 years ago. And then as the glacier melted, they moved north. Muskies came first. And then as the waters receded, a lot of muskies were trapped in these pothole lakes that didn't have any ingress or egress. That's the lakes that become what we call allopatric muskies-only lakes. And this was... Then pike came later, and you know, those lakes they couldn't get into, but the lakes that were connected to the river system that the pike could get into, and that's, you know, that's where the bigger fish comes from. But it's an interesting thing to go into geology and go back 10,000 years and and see how things developed. And, you know, we anglers, we get anxious and we want changes done immediately, but all this stuff started long before we were around 10,000
Good point.
It ain't going to be changed overnight.
No. No, that's a really good point, is that, yeah, I mean, it took us a long time to get here, and it's not going to happen probably in our lifetimes, right? To see, I mean, do you feel like everything you've done with Muskie's Inc. and in your life and your career that you're going to see the benefits of this maybe, long after you're gone?
Oh, yeah, I think the most important is catch and release. I was really in the forefront of getting that going around here. I had the one resort owner lady told me, she says, "You can't ask the guy who comes up here on vacation from Missouri to catch a muskie and then let it go." And I said, "Why not?" And so about 10 years later, after it really took hold, she became one of the biggest promoters of catch and release in the area. So it was kind of funny to watch that transition.
Imagine embarking on a journey to Alaska, that ultimate destination for adventure seekers. With Fishhound Expeditions, this dream can become your reality. Picture yourself amidst the wild Alaskan landscape, where the northern lights dance across the sky and you're reeling in some of the biggest rainbow trout you've ever seen. It's an experience that feels like a dream, but with Fishhound, it's an adventure waiting to happen. If Alaska is on your bucket list, Fishhound Expeditions is the key to unlocking that dream. Visit fishhoundexpeditions.com today and mention that you discovered them through this podcast. That's FISHHOUND Expeditions. Don't just dream about Alaska, experience it with Fishhound. How long did it take that transition to make when you first started talking about it to where everybody, most people were kind of taking it in?
Some people took on to it almost immediately. For instance, Lake St. Clair is in Michigan. It's basically it's a 330,000 acre muskie fishery nursery. Puts out thousands and thousands of muskies every year, and yet it took the anglers there longest time to adapt to catch and release. And they use big boats over there, a lot of them, and they troll with multiple lines, and a lot of them, a lot more lines than they're supposed to have out. And when they catch a fish, rather than stop the boat and handle it properly, they just skid the fish in across the surface and net it, keep right on going, and then unhook the fish and torpedo it over the side and hope it lives.
Yeah.
And so when we had a big tournament over there one year, a lot of our contestants were coming in during the pre-fishing days and complaining of all the dead floaters they were seeing. And that's why, because they were just pitching them over. And I watched the video one time, guys caught one and they kept right on going and they threw it over the side and you could see it came back up on the top limb on the side. And the guy said, "Well, we'll check on it later." They never came back and checked on it later. And besides, it was probably dead by then anyway.
Jeez.
It took a long time for that to take hold over there, but now it's just as prevalent there as it anywhere else.
Yeah, it is.
And a lot of that due to Muskie's Inc. too, I think.
Right, Muskie's Inc. Okay. And you mentioned some tournaments. Is that still a really big thing out there? There's lots of muskie tournaments in your area?
There's quite a few. There are people who absolutely detest them and fought them for years. And then, we got one professional trail going. That's been going now for over 20 years. I helped start it and then let the guys take over. And they've been going for 20 years, and they probably have an average of 80 boats at each tournament. There's lots of guys that go to every tournament on the trail. But, it's not for people who don't have a lot of money or time to get off to go fishing.
Yeah.
You got to travel and you got to pay for a motel and gas, and you go to pre-fish, and it's not a poor man's sport.
Right? No, it's not. It's not.
Just getting geared up tackle-wise is not a poor man's sport either.
Let's talk about that a little bit on the fishing. What is your fishing like? Talk about the gear you use, and what are maybe a few tips that you would tell somebody to help them maybe get their first muskie.
Well, the thing that in one respect irritates me more than anything is so many of these musky fishermen today would rather buy another lure than buy a book that tells them about the history of their sport. And I say that as a disgruntled author of compendium of musky angling history. But a lot of them cheap out on rods and reels, even though they'll buy a... Now, lures are selling... Criminy, I know some that sell up to $900.
What?
They're making them in limited quantities and putting them up for bid.
$900 for a lure?
Yep, and I would probably guarantee you that lure never sees water.
Jeez, no.
That's just how crazy some of these guys are. So they'll buy good lures, but they won't buy good rod, reel, and line to handle them with. So, but to get geared up properly, you're going to spend some serious money.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, $200 or $300 rod, or up, they go up to $600 or more for custom. Big reels are running anywhere from $300 to $600. Good line, which is probably the best deal going now with the super lines, is even though it's expensive, you buy a 100-yard spool of Seaguar for 80-pound test for $30, but it lasts for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unless you're pounding every day. I mean, you might have to change every season if you're pounding every day, but for the average week fisherman, it'll last him 5 years without any problem and still be like brand new.
Right.
So, and the other thing is, well, do you pay a guide or do you want to buy your own boat? So many people, I mean, the boat industry just exploded.
Yeah, it's spendy.
You can see what Bass did to the Ranger. Well, if you go to these tournaments now, at least half the boats in the tournament are Ranger boats, $100,000 rigs. And so, yeah, that's not a poor man's sport. But yet, the poor man can do it, too.
I mean,
there's places where you can fish offshore, places where you can rent a boat for $5 or $10 a day and go out. I mean, it doesn't have to be an expensive sport, but most of these guys now are crazy and they want the best of the best and they want to go where the fish are, and it's kind of a crazy game these days.
I got it. So that's it. So there's all sorts of different people out there doing this. What would be a few of your tips? You've caught some nice fish in your life. If somebody was hitting musky for their first time, what would you tell them to have a better chance?
Well, if first of all, like I said, there's a lot of waters that have the allopatric strain where there's more muskies in the lake because there are no pike. Even though they don't get as big, they're easier to catch to get your feet wet. So, you know, a lot of guys, they want to get in the game and go right away, want to catch a 50-incher.
Yeah.
That's going to happen unless you got a guide and you get lucky. But get your feet wet, learn how to catch the fish, learn how to handle the fish, and then you can save your money and go someplace like Green Bay or the St. Lawrence River or the Georgian Bay that's got the big fish, Eagle Lake in northwestern Ontario, Lake of the Woods, and not spend a whole lot of money and have a shot at a really big fish.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't come, you know, they don't come like popcorn.
No.
All the forward-facing sonar guys are kind of making it easy.
Yeah. How many in your days fishing just with your regular, you know, over the years, do you think, you know, how many days per muskie are you, like in a day of fishing, are you getting like one shot or are there days when you get lots of shots?
It depends where you're at. If you're targeting big fish, you might not see a fish. Out on the Otto and the St. Lawrence Rivers, when I was fishing, let's say more than 10 years ago when things were pretty darn good, we would go for 5 days, and we'd catch, in July, we'd catch 24 fish, and six of them would be over 50 inches. We'd go back in August for 5 days, and we'd catch 40, and still only six of them over 50 inches. But, you know, almost assuredly, in fact, almost every trip that I go out there, one of us in the boat gets one over 50, and sometimes all three of us. But, you know, we're using a guide that's probably the best on the planet, and so our odds are a lot better than anybody else's. But,
yeah,
the guys can do it on their own, too. But, again, you got to go where the big fish are. And, of course, the game today is there any new secret spots that hasn't been plucked to death? And that's the constant search. There's been, over the years, there's been, like Lake Wabagoon in the early 80s went nuts and a lot of big fish were caught. And as the word got out, more and more people got there. And then pretty soon they had to shut the fishery down completely because too many big fish were being killed.
Mm.
Well, then the next thing, Lac Seul did the same thing. It went nuts for a while and everybody went and more big fish were killed and they couldn't stand it. So they shut it down and now it's catching release only. And this is back in the early 90s when they shut it down and made it catch and release only, and it's still catch and release only. And so then Leech Lake, or not Leech Lake, Mille Lacs Lake in Minnesota went nuts, and it got pounded to death, and then the Vermilion went nuts, and it got pounded to death. So they chase the bite all the time, the hot bite, basically, is what it's called. And that takes time, and it takes money, and it takes knowledge. But with the internet today, there's no secrets anymore.
No. Is Lake Wobegoon, is that how is that doing these days?
It's fine now. People are still catching big fish there. Most of them ain't talking. You know, they claim it was really hurt bad, and I think it might have been wounded. But even after the masses left, it was still putting out big fish. It just wasn't putting out as many of them.
Yeah, gotcha. What is your currently, what are you working on? What's keeping you busy these days? Or is you know what I mean? You're kind of, it sounds like you've done so much in your life. Anything getting you excited?
Oh, yeah, I'm still excited. In fact, the last couple of weeks I've been working on a friend of mine had a musky book collection. He's 82 years old and starting to lose his memory a little bit, and he wanted to try to get rid of it. And so I've been helping him with that. And it's amazing what some of these collectors will pay for some of these books. It ain't near as good today as it was, say, 10 years ago. But there's some of these books that are very valuable. And so I've been working on that. And then opening day here is about a month away. And but I don't fish much around here anymore because I just get tired of not catching a little fish.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so my trips are a week in July, a week in August, and a week in December. On the St. Lawrence River and the other river. Yeah.
And that's because you got a good chance at getting a big muskie there.
Right. And I spent a week last year on the Georgian Bay in September, or excuse me, October. And, you know, shot at a big fish, but we fished for a week. Three of us never saw one. But DNR's netted some big ones there, so we know they're there. But, you know, they don't come easy.
No. No, they don't.
They're really big ones. And Georgian Bay is kind of got some really big fish, but the density of the fishery is, and particularly in some of the areas, is very low. So you're looking for a needle in a haystack most of the time. But if you catch that needle, it's going to be a big one.
Yeah.
I mean, you catch little ones too, but the odds of catching a big one, if you spend a lot of time there, are really good.
This is great. Have you been, I mean, what we mentioned lakes and rivers. Is there a big difference between fishing a lake versus a river? I guess it depends on the size, but are those fish migrating a lot? Are you catching the same fish in both those areas?
It depends. Like the St. Lawrence River, where it starts coming out of Lake Ontario, it's 7 miles wide and averages 2 miles wide all the way down. That's a lot of water, and it's current most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And fish locations in those situations are totally different than lake fishing. So, you know, if you don't have a guide or haven't been born in a place like that, it's tough to go there and find fish. But once you learn, you know, the nuances, it's just you got to be able to play the current and you know, you got to know where the likely spots are, or you got to find the likely spots. But it's just the rivers are different.
Yep, that's it. Nice. Well, and I you just had a couple more for you here. I wanted to take it out of here in a little bit. Starting this off, I wanted to just do this quick little segment. This is our podcast passport segment, and today it's presented by Visit Helena, Montana. We're doing a great trip to the Missouri River this year for trout, my first time fishing that, and we're going to be swinging by there. So you mentioned a little bit on your travels. So you do have some travels. Have you also, you know, maybe starting there, have you in your past traveled and fished all over the country? Are there other areas that, you know, you've enjoyed hitting?
I lost a 40-pound tiger muskie fishing in Washington State.
Oh, there you go.
My daughter lives out there, and so she belongs to one of the Muskies Inc. chapters out there, and so flew out there, and we went to a lake where they stocked them, and they raised rainbow trout, and the muskies get fat on the rainbow trout, I hooked and lost a 40-pounder, and then the next morning I took my daughter there, and she wasn't paying attention, and the fish come roaring up behind her bucktail. It was a giant, and she didn't get it, but it confirmed to me how big it was.
How big was it?
40-pound class.
Wow, and the tiger, talk about that. Is that the species, a different species or a subspecies?
Well, they're really not a species. They're a hybrid cross between a female muskie normally and a male northern pike. It can happen the other way around, too. There are some DNRs out that way, that are, like there's hybrids in Idaho and Washington and Colorado. But some of them use it the reverse, but to my mind, it's got to be a lot more difficult because the pike ripen up and they're ready to go at least 2 weeks normally before the muskies. So it's easier to have a holdover male northern pike to mate with a female muskie than it is to have a male muskie to mate with a female northern. It works both ways.
It does. And what do you know a little bit of that history? When did the why did a tiger muskie come to be?
There's always been native natural tiger muskies.
Okay.
But they weren't really identified until 1938. Now, for instance, in 1919, a fellow named John Nabla, Indian guide, caught a 51-pound, 3-ounce muskie out of Lac Vieux d'Isere in northern Wisconsin, headwaters of the Wisconsin River. Well, as it turned out, the fish wasn't a muskie at all. It was a hybrid. But it, for Field and Stream, it was the muskie record for 10 years. Well, in 1938, in the 30s, the Wisconsin DNR, there was a few guys that started questioning these odd-looking muskies. And Alfred Weed from the Museum of Natural History in Chicago finally figured out that they were crossed between muskies and northern pike. And then in 1970s, when I was the world record secretary for the Fishing Hall of Fame, we recognized the hybrid category. And because we weren't 100% sure that the Nabla fish from 1919 at that time was a tiger, we put another fish in that weighed 50 pounds, 4 ounces, caught by a woman in the same lake. And then a few years later, my cousin, who's a fishery biologist from Minnesota, was digging through some old magazines, and he found a picture of the Nabla 1919 fish in a 1920 Outdoor Life magazine. And that confirmed beyond any shadow of a doubt that the fish was a tiger. So it is now recognized as the Tiger Muskie World Record for both the Hall of Fame and IGFA. And of course, my program, we started fresh, so our record is 44 and a quarter pounds, but it came out of Utah, of all places.
And Tiger Muskie, they plant them out west because they do better out west? Is that kind of what's going on?
Well, they don't want them to reproduce.
Oh, right.
They use them for, like, in Washington, they were trying to control squawfish and other, you know, nasty stuff. And so by using tigers, they don't reproduce. And so they can control the fishery that way.
Yeah. Right on. Wow. That's amazing. So you get tiger muskie and maybe just,
and they are beautiful.
They are beautiful. Yeah. So how do they look different than say, it basically looks just like a cross, like a little both.
They look totally different than a muskie. The ones that come out of the waters where there are St. Patrick waters where pike and muskies exist together naturally, they almost look silver with broken bars and spots, alternating rows of bars and spots throughout their body. Fins are rounded tips and much bigger than the muskie's fins for the same size fish. They're just a spectacular animal.
Wow.
But in native waters, hybrids are bad. Where pike get into these lakes that only had muskies in them before, they take over.
Oh.
They take over and they displace muskies, and they don't reproduce. So somewhere down the road, there ain't going to be any more muskies in that lake. Won't be in my life, but it's going to happen.
Yeah, it'll happen eventually. Anything else you want to highlight just from, you know, that we, I know, I'm sure there's lots we didn't cover, but any big points in the history of kind of, you know, musky fishing and what you've been, the work you've been doing over the last 60 plus years?
Oh, it's just, it's such a fascinating history and it would take me several hours to
more
start
time
at the beginning.
Well, tell me this, Larry, where could somebody go right now if they want to take this further? I know you've got some books, maybe talk about your books and then where could somebody take this conversation further?
Well, my latest books, I did two. I did the third revised and expanded edition of my compendium of muskie angling history. And it's a huge two-volume set that is available on Amazon. I've run out of personal stock, so I'll just refer everybody to Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came out with my latest endeavor was a book of muskie postcards. When I started collecting muskie postcards, I had no idea how many were out there. The book that I did was volume one. I was going to do two volumes, but it didn't sell on that great, so I'm not going to do volume two. But there's over 750 muskie postcards in this book. And I probably got another 500 or 600 that I could put in another book. And what I figured out was that starting in the probably in the teens through the 20s, particularly in 30s and 40s, that postcards were a means of advertising for the hunters of the resort. For instance, around this area, there used to be 400 resorts that catered to muskie fishing, and now there's less than 100. But their method of advertising and for many years, and still some places do use postcards.
Yeah.
So it's the history just in the postcards, and what's good about it for people who don't like to read, you just look at the pictures. There's very little writing in it, just lots and lots of photographs of postcards. So that's also available on Amazon, and both the compendiums and the postcard book are also available by Kindle for people who don't want to buy a book.
Oh, cool.
And want to look at it on their iPad.
There you go. Good deal. And then who would be somebody or another resource or resources out there if somebody wanted to take this conversation further, learn more about the history of muskie fishing? Where would you direct them?
Oh, boy. My books.
Yeah, your book. There. Tell me that, Larry. How did you have a mentor along the way, or did you just teach all this, you learn this yourself as you went?
When I got hooked on muskie fishing back in the day, there was no sports shows for muskies. And so when I'd find a magazine on the newsstand, and back in those days it was mostly Field and Stream, Outdoor Life, and Sports of Field, well, if I found a muskie article in them, I'd buy it. So I've got hundreds and hundreds of articles from the old magazines, and then I started collecting books, and I thought at one time I had every muskie book that was ever printed. Boy, was I wrong.
No kidding.
Yeah, there's so many books out there that, particularly books that's got something to do with muskies within it, maybe a few pages, maybe a chapter, but then pure muskie books that are totally nothing but muskies, there's probably 100, 150 of those.
Yeah. What does your library look like there? Do you have it? Is it, does it full of muskie books and shelf books and books?
I'm sitting here looking at it, and it looks like the shelves are so heavy they're starting to lean.
What are you going to do? I always ask, I always think of this question because with this podcast, you know, we have over 600 interviews with some of the, you know, greats in fishing. And I think about, like, after I'm gone, you know, what happens, right? So, like, with yours, do you have a plan for all that great history and all that stuff?
Yeah, I've got a couple options. In fact, this guy that I just worked with, his collection was 447 books.
Wow.
And just in the last few days, we've been transferring most of it. He wanted to keep the collection intact. We've been transferring most of it, donated it to the Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame.
Oh, wow.
And then the duplicates, we're trying to sell those separately, of course. And then I'm on my second collection. I've probably got a couple hundred in my second collection, but I had 540 in my original collection before I sold it.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
So where did that collection go out, sold to just to whoever, or is there a...
It went to an individual.
Yeah, so one person has the whole thing.
Yeah, I don't know what he had a big collection to start with. And I've got a friend that helped me do an appraisal in this current collection. That his collection's over 900 titles. So
man,
there's a few guys out there that are really hardcore into this. When I did my third edition compendium, I did 30 sets of leather bound. And the reason I only did 30 is because I figured the hardcore market was about 25 different guys.
Yeah.
And I was right. I never had any more demand than the ones that I sold.
Oh, no kidding. Right. There's like 25 or 30 guys that are just the hardest core guys out there.
Right. That I knew about. I mean, there may be others that I don't know about, but I was pretty heavy into the book business for a while. I'd bought and sold a lot of musky books.
Yeah.
And it kind of died out a little bit, so I haven't done that much with it lately. I've still got quite a few for sale, but
yeah.
Well, this guys today, they want it on their telephone, on their phone.
Yeah, they
or
want it. Just like now, right? We're talking on a podcast, so this is going to be all audio, although we will have a blog and there will be some information on it people can read. But
in some of these books, when it was at its peak, for instance, the Louis Sprayer, we were talking about him earlier, he did a book back in the 70s, and I sold several of those for $1,000 a piece.
Wow, $1,000.
Yeah, that's because they're hard to get. There wasn't that many of them.
Oh, what would be one book that you know of that would be something somebody can get a hold of right now that would be a good book to learn more about, say, the history of muskie and all this?
If they could find it, and you can still find them probably on eBay, and they don't cost that much. I mean, they'll cost you 50, 60 bucks. But I grew up with the book called Muskie Fishing by Bert Claflin, 1948. And it's still my favorite book, even though, well, I shouldn't say that. Mine are my own books are my favorite. But yeah, the book Muskie Fishing by Bert Claflin is just, it'll hook anybody.
Oh, good. We'll put some links out to that book in the show notes and some other things we talked about today. And yeah, we'll send everybody out to LarryRamsell.com if they want to check out your more information. I know you have some information there, and also we'll have links to Muskies Inc. and everything else. So yeah, Larry, I think we'll leave it there, and hopefully we can follow up with you down the line and see how things are going and do a follow-up on this. But yeah, I appreciate all your time today and all the great work you've done over the years.
Thank you much. I appreciate it, and I enjoyed it. Always love talking muskies.
Yeah. That was a good one. Wow. I enjoy the history. I hope to get Larry back on again. He's got a ton of knowledge, and let me know if you get a chance. If you listen to this to the very end here, you have a comment, head over to Instagram. That's a really easy place you can do it. Wet Fly Swing on Instagram, and find that post with Larry and leave a comment. And if you get a chance, please follow this show. That's the best way. Click subscribe or follow on whatever app you're using is the best way to make sure that next episode gets tucked into your inbox without you even having to lift a finger. And the next episode we have this week on Friday, we're back for In the Bucket. Brian Niska's back to dig into more spey, skeena, swung fly techniques. Stay tuned for that one. And then on Monday, we got Topher Brown, who is back as well upon request. That first episode we have, Topher was so good, we had to bring him back on to get round two. So we're going to talk Atlantic salmon and again, spey, everything there as well. So we got some musky mixed with a couple of spey, some steelhead, Atlantic salmon. What are we missing? Let me know. Send me an email, dave@wetflyswing.com. I'd love to hear from you if you're new or if you haven't chatted for a while. Let me know how we're doing. If you have another episode you'd love to hear, I always love getting requests and putting those together. All right, off to the next one. I hope you have a great morning, a great afternoon, or a great evening, wherever in the world you are. I look forward to catching you on that next episode. Have a great day.